Welcome to Art Robot Death, a podcast about art, technology, and society. I'm your host, Timothy Reuter. With me today is Nick Ervink. Nick's work consists of large installations, handmade and 3D printed sculptures, ceramics, prints, drawings, light boxes, and animated films. I was attracted to it and wanted to speak to him because it felt like something genuinely new. He is based in Belgium. Nick, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So on this show, I interview people who are at the intersection of physical and digital art. What made you want to study computer modeling for sculpting? And how has your idea of what you would do with those skills changed from when you studied at the Royal Academy of Fine Arts in Ghent?
I will maybe introduce a little bit how it comes that I'm so attracted to the physical world and the digital world. So as many kids, I started just with Lego cubes. You really saw already a difference. I was not like playing, but really always building with my cubes. Then I was lucky to be born in this kind of computer generation, not yet the new generation we have today, but I had like a computer on an age of 13. And then I also had like, I think typical kids, this game addictions, like on an age of 15, you cannot say anymore that you play with Lego cubes. So it was really not just playing games, but really being addicted to games. And then having an excuse going back to art school on an age of 15 to be back physical, be back making sculptures, working again, then going to art school in Ghent, where I really didn't have a match with my teachers. I didn't have somebody to talk about sculpture. So I was much more back attracted to video art, to performance, to a sort of more virtual world. Then changing of education and meeting like a fantastic teacher that I had back a story about sculpting and could back do what I really love. And of course, the moment you graduate, you have a big problem. You don't have money. You don't have a studio. So then, of course, this virtual world was fantastic for me because I had a big studio space virtual. I could imagine my sculptures 10 meter size. I could make them in marble and in bronze. I could dream and develop my ideas. So for me, this display between this virtual and physical world is something that always was in my little life track and is getting a sort of very obvious for me today. Even it takes a lot of energy because you have to invest in the knowledge of the two mediums. You have to invest in the machines of the two mediums. But I really believe that my added value is also this kind of dialogue between this virtual and physical world.
Right. And so a few questions off of this. One is, I guess I was taking this off of your bio where you said that you studied computer modeling, but it sounds like that wasn't initially what you were doing. How many other students were there at your institution who also wanted to figure out how to use, you know, computer-aided design tools to create physical things?
Maybe one or two or maybe zero. So just to give you an idea, when I made my first 3D animation, I had to go to a supermarket for, the little trolley and put my computer from the room where I stayed to go to the school because they didn't have a computer on the school where they could play my animation. So even I was this maybe new generation at that time.
What year is this?
2001, 2003. But even today, they are not educating 3D animation, for example, on art schools in Belgium. So there's still a very long way to go. Or we had this kind of big montage studio where you could montage movies. But it was like a changing time because for $100, you could buy a video card. And I could do much more than they had this massive montage studio. So this was, of course, a change, the time that was changing. And I had to look. I studied a little bit of ceramic, a little bit of photography. I graduated in mixed media. I would say I have not learned to work with a computer on school. I have not learned to work with fiberglass. I have not learned to sculpt on school, but I met this like fantastic teacher that let me dream, that let me develop my own language. And I think that's really difficult. It's almost, if you have good hands, you can easily learn a woodworking machine. If you have a little bit computer knowledge, you can easily practice and learn a software. But to learn what is good taste, what is good art, what is bad art, is something very difficult. And there's no manually today that can do that. So it's a strange education. We started, for example, with 600 for the exam to start. We have a sort of exam to be allowed to go to art school. 60 people were allowed to start the study. And after 4 years, 15 have graduated, and 3 are still active as an artist. So this is the reality. And maybe other people have a much better job, a much easier life. Right. And next to me, even in the starting exam, you have like people that are 10 times better in drawing. So it's not about just craftsmanship. They were looking what kind of people have a backbone. I don't know always how they really decided. Sometimes you have to have luck and you have to meet the right people. But this is a little bit how it went for me at that time.
So do you think going to art school was useful? I hear you saying, on the one hand, they didn't teach you the techniques that you now use. But on the other hand, some people were willing to mentor you, and you got some perspective on sort of big picture questions about the meaning of art and what is quality of the art. So was that the right choice to go, or would you rather just have started trying to create things and see where that took you?
I personally don't believe it's necessary, but I personally believe for me it was necessary in the sense I came from a culture background. So getting like art history, meeting just like people that have the same creative goals in life. Even the lessons I had from my teachers were really interesting. So for me, I would not be an artist if I didn't do that art education of these steps. But for example, in Belgium, we have some wonderful artists. One has a background as a chef cook. Another has a background as a gymnastic teacher. Another one has a background as a doctor in mathematics. So there's nobody asking to an artist if it's an artist with a degree or not a degree. It doesn't make you a better or worse artist. But I think, of course, it's more logic to take that step. I think to say you don't study, then it's probably very difficult to find your way. And of course, you will always have people that find their way without an education.
Right. And one more fun biographical question before we move to the next session. What are some of the video games that most influenced you? And do you still play any video games?
Of course, I think I'm not yet old, but I'm also not a new generation. So it are, of course, games from a different time. But for me, the games that I loved were like SimCity, where you had to build a completely town, where you have to make your taxes, your traffic transport, and all the games in that genre. You had Sim Tower, where you had to build your own hotel. Pizza Tycoon, Theme Park, so Settlers, that generation of games. I never played really like the shooting games or the sport or racing games, but then also games like Red Alert and Command and Conquer, where you had to build your own army and build out your own army and conquer the other world. So in the philosophical world, they call that the God games. It are games where you are sort of God, you control, you build your own world. And of course, this is definitely something that developed me as a human being, as an artist. And it's definitely something you still see an influence in that. I also decided to not play any game anymore after an age of 18, probably because I have this addiction. So it would be very horrible for me.
Yes.
And I play it maybe now and then with some friends, and I do have some games on my cell phone to work in between. But it's something I try to keep off and to concentrate on my art.
I've had a similar journey where I just decided it was too addictive, and I could either do it a lot or not at all, and I now do very little. So transitioning a bit, I'd like to do a deep dive into the production of one of your works or exhibits. So looking at the St. Jakobskirk, I am absolutely butchering that. I apologize for my pronunciation, but looking at that exhibit, can you talk us through how you conceptualized the work there and went from design to production on the largest piece for that exhibit?
First I got, of course, the question to do a show there. It's really like in the old city center of Ghent. It's a huge, huge church. It's very Baroque, so it's not easy to do an art exhibition. So putting something small would not work there, or you have to do very subtle, very small, different interactions. So I immediately knew I wanted to do something big. I was developing this kind of new body of work that, for me, it's something between the abstract sculpture of Henry Moore and maybe the like flesh paintings of Francis Bacon, this kind of alien science fiction movies we have. And one thing, I started to develop this kind of sculptures in a virtual world, and I printed them on a sort of fabric 7 meter high, and they were as a sort of vandals in the church through the Harrow narrowways. Then I also made some big sculptures from 2 meter to almost 4 meter 50 high. And what is there sometimes difficult, I have a lot of different kind of methods. So one method was really designing the sculpture in computer, like throwing 300 hours on it on the computer, and then translate it manually in a physical piece. But the biggest piece of the show, I just started with a block of foam, with a block of styrofoam, cutting in it, putting a new piece in it, putting another piece, until I had like a shape that really worked for me. I call it almost like a sort of hongshi, big like a strange rock figure. Then we put metal in it because it's else not not working for the stability. And then it's covered with fiberglass, three layers of polyester with fiberglass. So it's really strong, weather protected. And then you have, of course, many layers and polishing and shaving in between. And then it's ready to do really the paint job. So I made a combination of like spray painting with a pistol, and at the other hand, really working manually and really see like the brush strokes. So I really wanted to have almost like a painting around my sculptures. So this was for me a different step than the most pieces that are like glossy Ferrari finish, much more this kind of design finish. So for me, it was definitely a step evolving and searching how I could almost have the poetry of like the ceramic pieces with little mistakes, with this kind of glaziers on a big size scale in fiberglass then.
And just to go into a bit more detail, are you comfortable sharing sort of when you're doing the computer design component, you know, what tools are you using? Is it Blender or what do you like to play with?
Yeah, we try to search as many programs as we finding, but we have, of course, all the standard graphic softwares. We have, of course, all 3D animating softwares. And today you have, of course, a lot of different softwares like Blender that is luckily free, but you also have 3D Max, you have Maya, you have certain programs, very little programs like Pipakura that can make an origami of all your sculptures. It's like a very little easy software. You have, of course, this kind of different software like ZBrush where you can model in clay. So today there are a lot of softwares. You have, of course, free open source softwares. Then, of course, you have a very expensive software. So I think it's all available. You have to find the program that works for you.
And are you going back and forth between all these programs for little tweaks? Okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
And Are you, so how much of this physical production do you do on your own with your own hands, or how much of it is a team? I mean, laying fiberglass is serious business. So
absolutely. Now, to let's say until 2011, I was also teaching for having a living, and then of course, luckily as an artist, you get more opportunities, you grow. So today I have a team of around 5 people, 2 people helping with the drawing team, because sometimes we draw like 1,000 hours on one sculpture. If you have to do that alone, you cannot do a lot on 1 year. And I have 2 people helping in the workshop, and one person helping with all the emails, administration, coordination. So this is a little bit how it grow and developed. So the whole St. Jakobskirk show, we did actually in-house. I sculpted myself, I painted myself, and then I have my whole team to help me. And other projects we will outsource, like, for example, really big sculptures and bronze and mirror polished steel and powder coated metal. We don't have the space, the machines, the people for that. So then you're much more working like an architect working with construction companies.
Right. And in terms of what you create when you primarily go from sort of digital to 3D printed or using a variety of machines, versus what you described for the largest piece in that exhibit, where it sounds like you mainly did it by hand, somewhat intuitively. Do you find you create different kinds of things through those different processes, or how does it feel to you as an artist doing one versus the other?
I think I love to search how does this virtual world works? How do you make a sphere in the virtual world? How do you make a sphere in the physical world? And use this knowledge from the physical world and the virtual world, and the knowledge from that virtual world and the physical world. So it's already a sort of dialogue between this physical and virtual world, but also working in clay and working with 3D printing, working intuitive without any sketch, without any ID directly in a block of foam, or really copying a computer model in a block of foam. So all this kind of different ways makes that I think I gave myself a huge freedom to work in, and you never are like repeating yourself. It stays evolving, and it stays a challenge for yourself.
No, that's interesting. And this is actually something that's come up in other interviews. You know, in some places where people develop a style, their desire is the market says, keep making more of that. Yeah. But the artist can sometimes find that sort of suffocating. Yeah. How do you think about doing something new versus doing what the market tells you it likes?
So let's say for my market, I'm mostly known for this kind of 3D prints that are smoothed and really glossy varnish. Mm-hmm. This is something like almost the brands. This is also the most... let's say good selling art pieces, but then I'm investing in doing crazy projects with innovative companies, really expensive projects, or making like very complicated 3D prints where you maybe work 3 years just on the drawing of the 3D prints. And I think it's good to find a balance in that. And I sometimes say, like, if you would give control to Nick Irving, the studio manager, you would have bad art. If you give control to the artist, you're bankrupt tomorrow. So you need to find this safely balance in that. And also, when people start to buy a yellow sculpture because this is your branding, and they're not interested in the white one or the blue one, that starts to feel very strange as an artist. So I don't want, like you said before, I don't want to be suffocated or to be obligated to make a certain type of work. So I make sure that I still have the freedom to go all directions I want.
Yeah. And how did you develop your specific style, which is continuing to evolve, but you do, as you say, have a brand that's well known and that, you know, provides you with standing.
I think the typical style, I call it the blob, the organic sculpture perforated with the holes. It's really started for me in 2009. where I had my first show in Shanghai. So I didn't really knew how will they look from a Chinese culture to my work. We have different backgrounds, we have different ideas. And I fell in love with this kind of temple gardens, this rocks cut out by the water, these rocks with holes in. And at the same time, I'm in love with especially the British sculptures like Henry Moore and Barbara Hepworth, that are seen as a sort of the inventors of the negative space. They are really some of the first sculptures that made holes in a sculpture. And of course, even today, you're limited to really your hand or your sizzle or your tool can reach. And of course, with 3D printing, it works completely different. You build up in layers, so you can really design the inside of your sculptures. You can go much further than that these artists did. And of course, the idea that negative space, that a hole in a sculpture, is actually only 100 years old is something crazy. We have a society with 100,000, millions of years of evolution, but the idea of a hole in a sculpture is not even 100 years old. So this is some crazy fact that is something that will grab me the rest of my life.
Interesting. And I know a lot of artists are quite worried about the role that AI will play in the future of art. What's your view on this? And do you think artists working in an exclusively digital medium will be impacted differently than those who produce physical artifacts like yourself?
It's the same, for example, like 3D printing. 10 years ago, everybody was afraid the economy will collapse, because in 10 years, everybody has their own factory and house. You don't go to the shop. It didn't take that fast that way. I think with IA, and I'm reading a lot of it, for example, today we're skeptic. Today we're skeptic. You don't want an architect working with AI, for example. But probably in maybe 5, maybe 10, it can go very fast. Maybe in the near future, you don't want an architect without working with AI. With AI will help to design your house better, more safety, more secured, cheaper, and you will have a different insurance if it's done by an architect with AI or not with an architect with AI. So maybe in the near future, nobody wants to have an architect without AI, because your house will be less secure. You will have to pay a bigger insurance, and you can go even to the car, because if you have self-driven cars, less people will drive, less people will be good in driving. So to have an insurance to drive will get more expensive, so even less people will drive. So the insurance to be able to drive will get even more expensive. So if you're against or for the future, it's a natural evolution. And IA will make sure that 100,000 of jobs will disappear, but 100,000 of new jobs will arrive. And we installed also like Stable Diffusion on the computer, and then you're like starting developing with AI, and you have suddenly like 50,000 cool images generated in 2 hours. You can make 100,000 yellow Picasso paintings with a horse and so many hours. But then what do? You get like a brain freeze. And I think for us today, IA can be interesting as a sort of in-between design tool. And of course, IA can generate easy, let's say, naked woman can generate easy cyborgs. But a lot of my work, like I call them the futuristic masks, for example, with all these lines, it's impossible to generate with IA. Yeah? Because IA is still copying the styles, still copying the info that it's got. So I think it will be even more interesting as an artist to go maybe the direction that IA is not able yet to do. Right. And of course, some maybe, let's say, crappy artists will be able to generate fantastic ideas or fantastic art with IA. But of course, I think it's the same. The first thing with IA, I was calling my teacher, "Oh, you have to know, we have found something. This is incredible." But the guy is 80 and had something. No, you will never compete that. Or it's the same like, they ask John Cage, IA made a fantastic song, but IA will never have sorrow, will never have love, passion, will never have dead. So it will be a perfect tool to imitate, and we will probably be able to go further and to learn it, but you will never be able to make the human soul or something like that. What will be the impact? I think not only on art, but on all businesses, as something probably frustrated, worried, and I think you cannot ignore it. And some artists will stay in an old world, mm-hmm. and other will evolve and adapt. And I think the most logic step is to adapt, of course.
Right. And that's what you've been doing in some ways your entire career. So that's a perfect segue to my next question, which is you've written, I have always been fascinated by how art developed due to new materials and techniques. Yep. Somewhat disappointed at contemporary sculpture and its lack of renewal. So I strongly agree with this statement of yours. Yep. And I'm often disappointed when I go to galleries and see things that seem like they could have been made 30 or even 100 years ago. And so what do you think it means for an art form to renew, or what did you mean there? And why is there so little renewal in sculpture or more generally?
I think, and I don't know if that's true, but of course the time 100 years ago was differently. There was no internet. Today as an artist, you cannot only stay in your studio. You have to have social media. You have to do marketing. You have to network. So it's a whole complexity to find time to find your balance in that. So I think that's one of the things. And another, I think maybe one artist is just happy with earning his money and painting, but I'm not happy with making just a nice work. I want to be innovative. And of course, to be innovative is difficult. You cannot reinvent the world tomorrow, or you can work with expensive technology, but then tomorrow I'm bankrupt. So you have to find this kind of balance. And I have been lucky to collaborate, for example, with Stratasys. It's a 3D printing company in Israel, and they have invented a full color 3D printer that can print transparency with colors inside. So we have made some mind-blowing sculptures, but it's still an expensive technology. Today, I have a grant from Europe, and I'm collaborating with two companies in Hungary, Primet and Lazaram, and they are making software and titanium 3D printers. So I'm working and developing now sculptures to print in titanium. The cool thing is I can go much tinier, fragiler, than I could ever work in plastic 3D printing, for example, nylon, ABS. So working with this kind of new technologies, they are challenging me, and they make that my output, my design, my ideas are completely changing. Mm-hmm. On the other side, the problem is that it's something I have to grow in as an artist. Now I'm starting to work a lot more in bronze. Bronze process is also something that 3D scanning, 3D printing, milling, all the technologies are evolving. And I do have much more crazy ideas, but maybe ideas that we don't have yet the technology to make them. Or I still need to have some more spare money to really develop this kind of ideas.
So actually, do you have an research and development budget for your studio? How do you think about doing that? Because obviously a lot of what you're doing, it's very unclear what the return will be or when you'll get that return. So how do you balance that as an artist and as a business person?
Yeah. I never had a business plan, so it's much more from a belly feeling, and I never had let's say a budget to do that or that. So it's just making that what you order and what you produce is of course paid. And I think the cool thing is that you have to jump in projects without knowing it, and that's of course scary. So from one mayor, I got a church in Corona. So I really get the church for 8 years available. This is something that you don't start on if you think reasonably. But this is something really cool. I can say I have my own church, my own exhibition space inside the church. In Corona, what was, of course, a hard time, the COVID period, I made a virtual museum. I was really ambitious. I made a 25,000 square virtual museum. It's online. You can visit it on my website. And I put 300 sculptures of mine in, 300 sculptures of artists I love to go and dialogue. Mm-hmm. This is a really losing project. But it's something that, from a passion, was great to do. I enjoyed it. Maybe it helps me in developing my work because I couldn't put my work and all this kind of materials and sizes I'm not able to do yet. And even today, I start a new crazy adventure. I just bought an old 1920 factory where most people say you have to demolish that and put something new. But I'm in love with this old building, so I want to build my studio there on long term. And these are even projects, you know, in front you don't have the money today, or some people say don't start on that. And luckily, an artist never thinks about that. I draw, for example, 2 years on one sculpture. I didn't knew if it would be possible. I didn't knew if it would sell. I didn't knew if I would have a client. And on the end, this was my best-selling sculpture. It has been exhibited in almost 15 countries worldwide. It's, in my opinion, almost like this kind of masterpiece that would earn its place in history. It's Aribert. Mm-hmm. You can look it up. This kind of blue head with all these veins. I think it's maybe one of the most complicated 3D prints of that time. But these are things, if you rationally think about it in front, you don't start on these projects.
Yeah. And so that leads nicely to my next question, which is, how do you define success for yourself? How do you know if you're sort of going in a direction that you're happy with, or where you feel like you're an utter failure and you should do something else?
Yeah, I just had last night a dinner with two creators from England, and we had a similar talk. For example, I want money to make my next art piece. Mm-hmm. I'm not interested to have a Ferrari in my garage or to have a luxury home. So mm-hmm. I'm still this dedicated artist that want to invest in my world. But of course, to pay my taxes, my team, my studio, my building, you need money. That's just the reality of the world we're living in. And success for me is to have recognition. Mm-hmm. It's not about money, but people that say you're innovative or you're of a certain of value. You're not just one artist, but you're maybe one of these artists that could mean something in mm-hmm. this line of history. What is, of course, almost impossible with 5 million people on the world or something like that. So I think this kind of recognition is probably something to find in yourself, to be proud on yourself and not what other people think about you. Because if you listen to other people, you will probably not make this art with critic or this art that stands out. But to believe in yourself and to find the values there, this is successful.
I mean, that's a really interesting tension because I think we're living in a world where people are very focused on this feedback loop between viewers, right? In social media. Yeah. And you specifically did say you want recognition, but on the other hand, you are also clearly very self-motivated to create a certain kind of art. Nobody told you to make this.
Absolutely.
So how do you balance that tension between the desire for recognition and you want to create a feedback loop where you're impacting people to some degree, but also following just sort of what's inside of you?
Of course, I think like everybody in the world, if you have like 1,000 likes, you're of course happy. If you have like only 0 likes, you're not happy or frustrated. That of course has an impact and will maybe also influence you or definitely influence your mood. But at the same time, I think as an artist, you have to be very strong in your own shoes. And if people like it or they don't like it, if it sells or don't sell, if you have success or don't have success, you have to be very stubborn and just do your own thing. And this is something very hard, but I think I had also a similar teacher like that. So it's something that I definitely have learned. I think I just follow my own path. And at the same time, you cannot ignore all the world around you. And if something sells really good, or if people are very enthusiastic about one show and less about another one, of course, that will influence your mind and your next step. That's logic.
Right. And what do you think it takes to be financially successful as an artist now? And why do you think you've been successful? So obviously you have incredible talent, but I've also met people I would consider very talented who struggle economically. So it clearly isn't just talent. Yeah. How do you think about sort of the path that makes something sustainable versus, you know, poverty?
I can say it, of course, very personal for me. And that's, of course, difficult, for example, to give advice to maybe some of your listeners or to younger generation, because every person has a different character, a different time, a different surrounding, a different type of art. But for example, I had the luck to win some contests. So that made that you got really good publicity, you got some money. Then I had luck to find like some really collectors that introduced me in a collector's world. We have lucky that in Belgium, we have a lot of people collecting art. And then I also had the luck to have like a first really big major commission from a private collector. And it's difficult to say that everybody in my virtual world, I can make it. Nobody believes that until you have made it. So you need to have this kind of starting chances to really build your path. And then I think I'm also lucky that everything I put my energy in works, but you cannot put your energy in sculpting and ceramic and being your own accountant and your own manager and selling. So this is, of course, the frustration that especially if you have a lot of passions, life is too short. And I'm lucky that because of my education, I'm trained to speak very verbal. So of course, if I have to go to the board of directors of a hospital or the council and the mayor of a city and to defend my project, that's of course easier if you can talk it with passion. So you can be the greatest artist on your attic, but if you never show your work, or you were not able to present it to people, if you then not meet a manager or a gallery that will do it for you, nothing will happen. So today, I think my luck is that I have this kind of combination in myself to be maybe a good manager and a good artist at the same time. And it's also being realistic in the sense, not floating, not pushing yourself, but also keeping a financial balance, not going too fast. But I believe in the idea of making steady foundations in your art practice and your oeuvre. You will maybe go a little bit slower, not go with the hype, not go with something that goes really fast, but build up maybe slower, but keep on building.
And do you think that the specific cultural context in Belgium that you're part of has influenced your work, or is that not particularly part of your story?
Absolutely. I think, for example, maybe even still today, as an artist, you should move to probably London, Paris, New York. This is where I think most of the really contemporary art world is still today. Mm-hmm. But of course, the competition is also 10 times tougher there. So it has its value and its disvalue. I think for Belgium, it's not easy to build up this kind of international track because we are a small country. But we have lucky to have this kind of major collectors with their private museums in their back garden. So if you would live, for example, in Oklahoma, or you would live in the desert, this is, of course, something you don't have. Mm-hmm. And this is, of course, something that helped me to financial survive because I have these collectors around me. Mm-hmm. You see that the culture, for example, in the Netherlands is already different. They have less collectors, but much more museums buying art. So it's again different from artist to artist, from country to country, from culture to culture. So for me, this is a culture that works. I live on the countryside. That makes that I can concentrate me. I have space to make this kind of sculptures. But this is, of course, a decision you make, of course, as an artist.
Right. Right. If you're doing some, you know, thing and you live in London, it's hard to find the space to create sort of the large kind of works that you do. I know you're in the middle of preparing for a new exhibit. Can you tell us a little bit about what you're working on right now?
It's one of the major cities in Belgium, Antwerp, that probably most people know from the diamonds and things like that. Mm-hmm. So it's a new gallery show for NQ Gallery in Antwerp. And we have painted the whole space pink, the ceilings pink, the pedestals pink. And it's a show concentrated not on my virtual work, not on my 3D printing, but a show solely on my manual drawings and my manual ceramic pieces. So what is really cool is that you enter this kind of new world. The moment you step in the gallery, you have the feeling that you're walking inside the world. And this is, of course, fantastic for me to create that. The opening is tomorrow, I think, in between almost 25 hours. So, of course, I'm curious how will people react. Will something new come out of it? But this is, of course, the nice tension and the nice desire you have as an artist working towards a show.
And who else right now is doing exciting things that you admire? Who else is in that process of helping renew art that you like?
I go first back to let's say the more classical artists. For mm-hmm. me, my big inspiration is Hans Arp, Henry Moore, Barbara Hepworth. And if you could see them as the grandfather and grandmother, then mm-hmm. I see artists like Anish Kapoor, Richard Deacon, Tony Crack as the children. And I hope I can be maybe one day somewhere in the line as the grandchildren. We will see. But of course, you have many artists that are interesting. For example, with digital, you have Koala. It's an Italian artist living in London. He's doing really cool things, I know. In New York, you have, for example, Ivana Brasic. She's also making something that's a little bit alien tension. I did a show, for example, now in the Netherlands, and there was a curator from Amsterdam, Maarten Spreut. He's coming from this kind of fashion background, doing scenography, but he was like a fantastic curator to make like a world and entering this kind of world and selecting all artists that are part of this world. Mm-hmm. Another Belgium artist that is interesting, for example, is Martin van den Einde. He makes like a sort of fossils coming from cell phones, like you would dig up a cell phone in maybe 1,000 years and it's getting like a stone with a cell phone fossil in it. So yeah, there are definitely probably 100 artists that I really follow and admire.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. And you know, are there any, before we break, final thoughts that you'd like to share with the audience on any of these themes related to how you do your specific work, renewal in art more broadly, what it takes to be successful? Any final parting thoughts, or we can
I would say I would invite everybody to visit a virtual museum. It's a museum. Mm-hmm. You can find it by clicking on my website. And for also the people that are passionate about books, I have also made a physical book about a virtual museum. But really, for collectors, it's like a book with 4 different of typos, 4 different of papers. It's with a linen cover. It's numbered and signed. It's a fold-out from the completely manual and ground plan of the virtual museum. And this is showing how I want to be as an artist. I would invite people to go to the Wikipedia. You have the Wikipedia, but you can go to the Wikipedia where you have all my titles, where you have the explanation of all my art pieces. Mm-hmm. And for me, but I think for many artists, it's inviting an audience to enter my world. And some people will hate it. Some people will be completely addicted and love it. And I think this is the beautiful part. As an artist, you're creating a world. You're inviting people to step in that world, to read about it, to learn it. How more you go in depth, how more interesting it gets. And I think this is something we definitely need against a world where everything is about money, about mathematics, about languages, about the rational things in life. We really need this balance for culture and to have emotion, to have feeling, to be human. And this is something that is, of course, also getting on a balance and is getting probably more difficult in the near future. And I think a lot of people are lost. How do we go with marriage today? How do we go with belief today? How do we go with food, with financial situations today? So I think most people are definitely looking for answers and to find this kind of new balance in life.
I think that's the perfect note to close out our conversation. Nick, thank you so much for being on the show. I really enjoyed our conversation.
I'm happy to. Thank you for the invitation.
Thanks to Nick Ervink for joining us, and thank you for listening. Again, I'm your host, Timothy Reuter. If you like this interview, please subscribe in your podcast app and leave a comment. If you'd like to reach out with any suggestions of people I should interview or any other feedback, you can email me at artrobotdeath, spelt as one word with no punctuations, @gmail.com. We look forward to having you join us for the next conversation.